Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
If your roof starts to leak or your floors really squeak, you live in a money pit.
Money pit.
If your basement needs a pump or your place looks like a dump, you live in a money pit.
Money pit.
Pick up the telephone, fix up your home sweet home. I call an 888 money pit.
Coast to coast and floorboards to shingles, this is the Money Pit. Home Improvement Show. I'm Tom Kreitler.
And I'm Leslie Segretti.
And whether you're a do-it-yourselfer or a do-it-for-me kind of home improver, we are here to be your how-to expert. If you've got questions about projects you'd like to tackle around your house, you're in the right place. Help yourself first, though, by reaching out to us with those questions at 1-888-MONEYPIT or simply go to moneypit.com/ask and click the blue microphone button. Hey, here's our first story for today's show. It's a fun one because even though we call lumber that we use for building homes 2x something, you know, 2x4, 2x6, 2x8, did you guys know that it actually measures a lot less than that? So we thought we might share why you may not actually be getting what you pay for when you buy your 2x lumber.
All right. And also ahead, we get a lot of questions about how to clean tile grout, which always seems to look great the day you put it in, and then it never looks as good ever again. It gets dirty, it gets drab, it's just gross. We're going to share a solution that can restore that new grout brightness.
And if you've been chipping away at a lot of ice this winter, we'll share a trick of the trade to help make it disappear, especially when it freezes a garage door shut. And that happens surprisingly often. I hear about it all the time. So we're going to tell you how to unstick your garage door.
All right. But most importantly, guys, we want to know how we can help you create your best home ever. From bathrooms to basements and demolition to decor, we're here to share non-biased expertise to help you tackle your to-dos with confidence.
So reach out to us right now, or really anytime a DIY dilemma comes to mind. You can reach us at 1-888-MONEYPIT or go to moneypit.com/ask. Let's get to it. Leslie, who's first?
Kayla in Iowa, you've got the Money Pit. How can we help you today?
Just got married and moved into a new home, and it already had a Honeywell whole home humidifier installed in it, and it seemed like a dream come true. I thought it was going to be amazing, but we have 100-amp service, and every now and then our breaker will trip, and you don't even know downstairs unless you're down there. And I've gone down a couple times, and the basement is flooded, and it floods, like, over into the other room, like, into the where I eventually want to lay carpet and have, like, a family room.
Is that because the dehumidifier condensate pump stops working?
I'm not sure what it is. There's, like, an overfill thing for it, and I'm assuming it's supposed to lead to a drain, but the drain is in the laundry room, which is in the opposite direction.
Okay, so when everything is working correctly, this dehumidifier is going to take moisture out of the air, drop it into a reservoir, which you either have to empty or it will pump out somewhere. Usually, if it's got a condensate pump associated with it, it can pump up sort of against gravity, and there's a clear plastic tube that goes out and leads to a drain somewhere or even outside the house. If you have a power failure, you know, it's not going to work. And it might actually start to leak maybe back into that room where you are. Of course, the dehumidifier is not working at that time, so it's not going to leak for long, but I could see how it could create a bit of a puddle. So your problem is not so much with the dehumidifier, but why you're having a problem popping these breakers. Now, 100-amp service is actually a pretty darn good service, and it frequently doesn't get the respect it deserves. When these breakers pop, it's not usually because you're pulling more than 100 amps. It's because whatever circuit you have on this particular dehumidifier on needs to be improved, perhaps by adding an additional circuit. But the service for the house should be fine.
Okay. It does have the clear hose that leads outside.
That's what's going on. When your power goes out, the pump stops working, and that's why it's leaking. Okay. So focus on getting this plugged into a circuit that is a little bit bigger than what you have right now. An electrician could help you sort this out, but it's not a big deal to add an additional circuit just for that device.
All right. Sounds good.
All right. Good luck with that project. Thanks so much for calling us at 888-MONEY-PIT.
We've got AJ on the line who's dealing with a newish house, about 9 years old, and it seems to be getting a lot of movement and some cracks are forming. What's going on?
There are now some cracks starting to show up in a few places, and the front door is jammed. It does not open, and various places, the large screws and nails are starting to show up on the wall. I have a feeling that the house is shifting. I don't know why, because it's only 9 years old, and I was wondering if you have seen or heard anything like that and what you might be able to recommend to me.
So, AJ, the fact that you've been there for 9 years, I presume it's you that have been in the house for 9 years and are seeing this now means there may be something new happening that's causing this kind of movement. Certainly a door that sticks, a door that needs to be adjusted from season to season, not unusual. But if it's all happening at the same time, then I think it warrants deeper investigation. The fact that you've got walls that have nail pops, very, very common, even some cracks around openings, around where there's intersections of walls and ceilings and that sort of stuff, also very common. But again, since it's happening all at the same time, I think the best way to get into this and find out if there's something to be concerned of is for you to hire a professional home inspector to do an inspection of the house, of these areas, and give an opinion as to whether or not this is an active problem or not, or hire a structural engineer to do the same thing. That's the first question, is it active or is it just normal expansion and contraction? The other thing I would say to look out for is whether or not there's been some change, especially with respect to drainage around the house. Sometimes when you get a lot of water that accumulates around a foundation perimeter, even from something as simple as a perennially blocked gutter, that water gets under the foundation and allows some shifting to occur because the wet soil gives way and lets the building move more than it would if it was dry. That could be a contributing cause. But if it's nothing obvious like that, I would definitely call a professional, get it evaluated so that you'll know what to do. I can't really speculate today beyond that, but those are the typical reasons that these problems develop.
Everyone should know that drinking water is important to staying hydrated and healthy. Having safe, clean water is the last thing you want to worry about, but unfortunately, according to extensive research by the Environmental Working Group, 3 out of 4 homes in America have harmful contaminants right in its tap water.
That's why we are thrilled to be working with AquaTrue. AquaTrue purifiers use a 4-stage reverse osmosis purification process, and their countertop purifiers work with no installation or plumbing. It removes 15 times more contaminants than ordinary pitcher filters and is specifically designed to combat chemicals like PFAS in your water supply. And they have water purifiers to fit every type of home, from installation-free countertop purifiers to higher-capacity under-sink options. They even have a Wi-Fi-connected purifier and mineral boost options.
And its proprietary purification technology is independently tested by IAPMO to NSF and ANSI standards to remove over 80 of the most harmful contaminants, including chlorine, fluoride, arsenic, PFAS known as forever chemicals, nitrate, and many more. I can truly taste the difference when I compare it with my old water filter. AquaTrue saves you money also. Just one set of filters from their classic purifier makes the equivalent of 4,500 bottles of water. That's less than 3 cents a bottle. Plus, you'll save the environment from tons of plastic waste.
AquaTrue comes with a 30-day money-back guarantee and even makes a great gift. And today, Money Pit listeners can receive 20% off any AquaTrue purifier. Just go to AquaTrue.com. That's AquaTrue.com and enter code MONEYPIT at checkout. That's 20% off any AquaTrue water purifier when you go to AquaTrue.com and use promo code MONEYPIT. MONEYPIT.
Heading to Florida where Carolyn's on the line has some rusty doors that need painting. How can we help you?
I'm needing to repaint or fix my garage doors. They're metal, and I don't know what I have to do. They do have some rust on them, and so I guess I'm going to have to sand them down and treat them, but I just don't really know what to use on them.
So that's a pretty straightforward project. So the first thing you need to do is you need to sand off those rust spots, because you don't want to paint over the rust. So you want to sand them off. You use a very fine grit sandpaper for that. Probably something that's around 200, 300 grit, like an emery paper, will work well for that. And then next, you do need to prime them. I would recommend Rust-Oleum, and you can buy that, you know, by the quart, by the gallon. You don't want to prime that whole door. And by the way, aside from sanding that rust spots, you want to lightly sand the whole door to make sure it's clean, because, again, you don't want to have anything in between that and the primer. Then you can use a Rust-Oleum primer on the entire door. And then on top of that, you're going to use, I would just stay with the Rust-Oleum line and use a top coat of color from there. It's a little tricky when you're dealing with garage doors. You have to sort of have them propped open a little bit, because otherwise the door, when it closes, it rubs against the weather stripping, and of course that mars up the paint finish. So you're going to have to sort of pick a day when it's warm enough where you can have that garage door open and let it dry. And just don't put it down all the way. If you leave it sort of suspended in the air about maybe halfway down, you'll probably be okay. I would work one side at a time. It's going to be a bit of a time-consuming project, but it's pretty straightforward and it's not that difficult.
Hey, you want to make our day? Well, go ahead and leave us a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts and we'll be jumping for joy. Plus, you guys, your feedback helps us make the show even better for you. Just go to moneypit.com/review. All right, now we've got Eric in Michigan on the line, who's got a question during a construction project here about an eaves trough.
The question is eaves troughs, yes or no? When you're building, does it make a difference if it's on a concrete slab or if you have a basement? Just your thoughts whether to install eaves troughs or not.
Yeah, Tom, I mean, I've never heard this term before. What is an eaves trough? Do we have those here?
Yes, you say gutter, but in Michigan they say eaves trough.
the famous tomato gutter.
Tomato, yeah,
eaves trough.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Your question is, do I need gutters? And yes, you do. It doesn't matter if you're on a concrete slab or if you have a basement, because the gutters are going to manage the water to the foundation perimeter, which is important in both cases. Now, if you let a lot of water run off your roof, even if you're on a slab, you're going to find that as the soil gets very wet around the foundation, you'll have more settlement and get some cracking. And also, in some cases, if there's a heavy rainfall, you get so much water that because concrete is so hydroscopic, it absorbs water like crazy, it can actually pull that water up into the living space of your house. Now you got mold issues and everything else. So, yes, you do need gutters. And if you have basements, well, if you don't have gutters, you're just waiting for a flood to happen. You're ready for it because it's going to happen. So, yes, put gutters on the house, put downspouts on the house. Make sure they are extended at least. This is new construction, so I would say at least 4 or 5 feet away. And when they do the final grade, do a little bit higher of a grade than they are required to by code, because it settles, and it settles quickly. And I can't tell you how many times I've seen the minimum grade just turn flat, like within 6 months to a year. Now you got no drainage at all, and the water's just sitting there. So that water management is really, really important, Eric, and that's why I think you definitely should have eaves troughs around the roof edge of your house.
That's fancy. I'm going to start using that every day in my life. Oh, that eaves trough is overflowing.
Use that in a sentence in your general conversation.
Hey, kids, keep those tennis balls out of the eaves trough.
There you go. Well, guys, if you're just getting started in home improvement projects, you may be confused by the way lumber is sold, because you actually get a lot less wood than you think you've paid for.
So, for example, let's say you're getting ready to build a shed and you purchased 2x4s to build the walls. Now, are you expecting that they actually measure 2 inches by 4 inches by whatever length you've got? Now, what you're going to find is that even though they are called 2x4, they actually measure 1 5/8 inches by 3.5 inches. And the same goes for a 1x6. You think you're getting a 1x6, but you're going to find that it really only measures 3/4 by 5.5 inches. So what the heck is happening to all that missing lumber that you thought you bought and you paid for?
Well, it's actually the effects of more modern lumber production. If you've ever seen a 2x4 in a really old house, you may notice it actually is 2 inches by 4 inches. But now when a tree is cut up to lumber today, those boards still start at about 2 inches by 4 inches, but when they're dried, which actually makes them stronger, and then planed to remove all the saw cuts, what you are left with is less. That 2x4 is now 1 5/8 by 3.5, and a 2x6 is 1 5/8 by 5.5, and so on.
Yeah, now the lumber industry uses two forms of measurement. It's dimensional and it's nominal. Dimensional is the size of the board when it's first milled at the lumber yard, and the nominal size is after it's dried and planed, and it's what you ultimately find in the lumber yard.
But the good news is that the length, well, that's always the length. So an 8 foot 2x4 is really 8 feet long, but 1 5 inches thick and 3.5 inches wide. Well, except there's always an exception, right? Because if you buy something called a 2x4 stud, which is actually 93 inches, any guesses why, Leslie, that is not 96 inches when you buy a 2x4 stud? 93, 3 inches short, basically.
Is it?
Yeah. Yeah. When you buy a stud, if it's called a 2x4 stud, it's actually 93 inches long. And here's why. Because it's designed to build a wall with, and the top and bottom sill, so the top horizontal piece of the wall and the bottom horizontal piece, is going to make up for that additional 3 inches and give you an 8 foot tall wall, which happens to be the same size as the drywall you're going to attach to it. So yes, if you buy a stud, it's actually shorter than just buying an 8 footer.
All right. I love it. Making things easy.
Or not.
Heading out to Fayetteville, Pennsylvania, where Deb's on the line. So I've heard about ring around the collar. I've heard about ring around the tub, but you've got a ring around the sink? What's going on?
My problem is that I have a bathroom counter combination sink that's beautiful. It's creamy yellow. I love it. Nothing's wrong with it, except right around the drain is this ugly black that won't come off. And my husband says we might have to just replace the whole thing. I said that's ridiculous. Everything's perfect except that spot. There's got to be something to use. He mentioned something like a lime away. We haven't tried anything yet. But it's, like I said, just a ring around the drain part. Everything else in the sink is perfect. I hate to get rid of the whole thing for that. There's got to be something. Even if we have to sand it or something, maybe there's a new product to get rid of that black. But it's really a shame because everything else is perfect.
Yeah, Deborah, I know what you're talking about. And what happens is that that is the area of the sink with a composite sink, which is pretty sure what you're referring to, where it really wears. The finish on the sink wears. And then over the years, you get just sort of the dirt and the grime that embeds itself into that space. Sometimes you get a reaction between the metal drain that's there and the sink itself. It's funny, you mentioned sanding. I think if it's you've done all this sort of over-the-counter products attempts, I mean, I would try CLR maybe just to make sure you check that off the list. That's the calcium lime rust remover. But I would try that. I would also try an oxygenated bleach. But if those two things don't work, you could consider disconnecting the drain, basically pulling that all out, and then seeing if you could abrade some of that dark area away with some steel wool. I don't think sandpaper will work, but it would allow you to have a better shot at it. And then when you put it back together, make sure you use a new drain connection from the top side, because you will stop getting any additional deterioration. And you might even consider one that's slightly wider. If it has a slightly wider lip on that metal drain, that would actually cover the old black, which is probably forming between the drain itself and the sink. So there's a couple of ideas for you. Hopefully one of those will straighten this problem out without you having to replace the entire thing.
Tuan in Nebraska's on the line with some help on an insulation project. What can we do for you?
The home is built in 1935, and I'd like to insulate the exterior walls. What would be the best way to do that? Either foam or blow-in insulation?
So you are confident that there's no insulation in those exterior walls right now, Tuan?
There's none in there. I'm very confident.
So because we don't want to have you open up all the walls, probably the best thing to do is to do blown-in insulation. That could be blown in from the interior or from the exterior, depending on where you would like to patch it. To blow in insulation, they drill holes that are about an inch to an inch and a half in diameter, and then usually you use cellulose that's blown in under a slight pressure. And it's important to work with a company that's very experienced with the product, because they have ways to make sure it gets to all the spaces it's supposed to get to, and accounts for settling of it. For example, one of the ways to do that is after the insulation is installed, they'll use an infrared camera to basically scan all your walls and look for cold spots. That would indicate a place where insulation did not get to. So I think blown-in is the way to go with that thermal verification.
Okay. So ask for a thermal verification.
Yeah, and it really shouldn't be anything extra. It should just be part of their tools, because otherwise, how do they know they're getting the insulation everywhere it should be? I would also tell you to make sure you double-check the amount of insulation you have in your attic, because as uncomfortable you think you might be because of those walls, They are actually responsible for a very small part of the heat loss compared to the attic. So you want to make sure that the insulation overhead in your part of the country is like 15 to 20 inches of fiberglass insulation.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome, Tuan. Thanks so much for calling us at 888-MONEY-PIT.
Darlene in Arizona, you've got the Money Pit. How can we help you today?
Remodeling a bathroom into a laundry room because there was no laundry room there and three bathrooms. So I put the stick-on linoleum squares on the floor, which was probably a mistake, but it's all down. And now I notice on the edges it's starting to pull up just a little bit. It's fine in the middle, but around the edges. And so I was wondering, should I use a silicone around, kind of pull them up a little bit, put silicone around there, or like a water-based sealant of some kind? I just didn't know quite what to do if we put the washing machine in there and there was a leak, and then I was afraid the whole floor would come up or something.
So do you think if you kept pulling the tiles, they would all come up completely?
I think the reason why the sides are, maybe the floor isn't quite even on the edges or something. I'm just thinking that maybe it wasn't quite even, and it's not every side, but just part of it, right where the washer is going to be, as a matter of fact.
Well, look, if you were to be able to lift up those edges and add a tile adhesive underneath that, a regular floor tile adhesive, the kind of tile adhesive that you would use if you're laying down these vinyl tiles from scratch, and then you weighted it while it dried, that'd probably be the best chance you got of preventing it from coming back up again. But I got to tell you that it's been my experience that once these seams start to go, you fix one and two more pop up. So this might be something you're chasing. And if it's only a small area, what you could also consider is basically replacing the vinyl floor with laminate floor. Just a small amount of laminate flooring won't be that expensive, and it can be laid down right on top of that vinyl floor. Laminate floors will float. They don't need to be attached. They sort of lock together, and they will lay down on top of that. You'd put a saddle in where you hit the doorways and that kind of stuff, but that would give you a really durable floor. You wouldn't have to worry about it.
Well, that'd be better than pulling it all up. That's a good idea. Thank you very much.
Good luck with that project. Thanks so much for calling us at 888-MONEY-PIT.
Well, tile grout is a pretty durable material for sealing the spaces between your tiles. But while it always looks clean and bright when you first put it in, it definitely climbs that gross scale pretty quickly thereafter. Now, the good news is that cleaning it is totally a DIY project, and it definitely can change the entire feel of the bathroom. It really brightens up the space. Now, grout gets dirty from mold, mildew, soap scum. So the first step to cleaning it is to pick the right type of grout cleaner for your tile. And there's two types, acidic and non-acidic. But choosing the right one doesn't depend on how dirty the grout is. It's based on that type of tile that you've got around the grout.
Well, that's right. So if the tile is your typical glazed tile, acid-based cleaners are okay. So opt for a good quality commercial tile cleaner and apply it with a stiff bristle brush or a non-metallic scouring pad. Be sure to wear safety glasses to keep those cleaners from spraying in your eyes as you scrub. Now, for unglazed tiles, these are very attractive, but they're definitely hardest to keep clean. It calls for a natural cleanser. So a paste of baking soda and water works well when applied with a softer medium bristle brush. And finally, for natural stone, don't use those acid-based cleaners, which can damage the surfaces of marble, granite, travertine, limestone, terrazzo, other natural materials. You can definitely use a non-acid-based cleaner or that natural paste method.
Now, with any of these, here's a tip. You want to pick up a grout brush. For a few dollars, it's going to save you a ton of time. It's a stiff bristle brush. It's shaped to get into those crevices that hold the grout, and it's got a comfortable handle, so you're not going to get worn out before the dirt leaves the grout, because it is going to be a lot of elbow grease here to get that grout clean. You're going to need to follow the directions of the grout cleaner, but it's usually the best to work from the top down, cleaning and rinsing and working in small areas at a time. It's okay to do a little bit and, come back the next day too, but always make sure you wash away the cleaner in the area that you've been working on.
Yep. Now, once your tile is bright again, let's keep it that way, shall we? And the way you do that is by applying a grout sealer. Now, silicone-based sealers are best. I suggest waiting a day or two for the grout to thoroughly dry and then apply the sealer. This way, it will soak in nicely. And by the way, it's also a good time to take a look at your bathroom vent fan. New ones can be automatically operated by a humidistat, so after a shower, they'll stay on long enough to vent out all that excess moisture so it doesn't settle on the tile and lead to quicker mold or mildew growth.
All right, now we've got Sue from Ohio on the line. Welcome to the Money Pit. How can we help you today?
Yes, we had a wooden wheelchair ramp built for my father, and it was the treated lumber, and wanted an idea or what product we could use to kind of keep the ice and the snow off of there without damaging the wood.
You know, there are different types of salts that can be effective as to prevent snow and ice. What you want to do, though, is make sure that you not use sodium chloride or rock salt. You want to use calcium chloride. Calcium chloride is less corrosive. It has less of an impact on plants and on pets, but does just as good a job of keeping the snow and the ice off. What I would suggest is you take this calcium chloride and you mix it up with playground sand, the kind of sand that you might put in, like in a sandbox, and create sort of a mixture that you can keep handy so that whenever you do get a little bit of ice and snow, you can spread the salt sand mixture down and keep that ramp clear.
Okay, great. Thank you.
All right, good luck with that project, Sue. Thanks so much for calling us at 888-MONEY-PIT.
Now we've got David from Ohio on the line who needs some help making paint stick. I know it's a tricky subject here, but sometimes it really just doesn't want to. What's going on?
I have questions about redwood siding. I have an older home built in the 50s. Paint has a hard time staying on the place. I've removed most of the paint. I'm coating it with a Kiehl's exterior oil base primer. I was hoping to find what a good top coat paint would be for that.
Well, you know what? It sounds like you're doing the right thing by priming that siding. Now, if it hadn't been painted, we would have told you to use solid color stain and not paint, because solid color stain, as it wears, as it ages, it sort of fades out. Paint, as you've experienced, as it wears, can tend to peel off. But the fact that you've prepped it and now have used a solvent-based Kiehl's primer on the whole thing, I think that was a really smart thing to do, because that is what gives you that it sort of locking sort of adhesion quality. Now, on top of that, in terms of paint quality, I would recommend a good quality paint, and by that I mean probably Sherwin-Williams or maybe Benjamin Moore, two very good brands. Within those brands, you're going to have choices as well. I always find, I usually go to the local Sherwin store near me, because the guys in there always know a lot about the different variations of paint product that the company makes and can give me a really good recommendation. So I think as long as you stick with those name brands, you're going to be fine. I wouldn't wait too terribly long between the primer and the paint, though, because you don't want that. The primer is not designed to stand up to weather, and you want to get it on as soon as weather will permit.
Now, here's a quick tip for a chilly problem. If you've been chipping away a lot of ice this winter season, you may know that that ice can also freeze a garage door shut. If you find yourself frozen in, first try disconnecting that automatic garage door opener and then try opening it manually. If that doesn't work, don't force it, or you could definitely damage that door. Go ahead and spray a lock de-icer along the bottom of the door. And if you don't happen to have one, you can use WD-40 as a de-icing agent, because that's, you know, another one of its many uses.
Now, you can also pour lukewarm water along the base and then slide a putty knife along the bottom to break away any remaining ice between the door and the concrete floor. It always amazes me how that seam is so, like, contact cement-like, you know, between the frozen rubber to the concrete. It just really takes a good effort to break it free when it happens. So now you're good to go.
Heading up north to New Hampshire, where we've got Catherine on the line, who's got a roofing question. I mean, it's a roof of a barn, but roof nonetheless. So what's going on?
I have an 1890s barn, 30 by 40, that needs a new roof. It has about 1-inch thick barn board going across the rafters. And I'm wondering if I can put either shingles or a standing seam metal roof right on top of the barn board, or if I need to put plywood or some other type of sheathing on top of that barn board before I apply the shingles.
Well, that sounds like a really beautiful building. And I'll tell you, as long as that sheathing is solid sheathing and not spaced sheathing. So in an old building like that, sometimes you have sheathing that's spaced upon which you would nail like a cedar shingle roof. If that's the case, you need to plywood that roof so you have solid sheathing. But if that barn board is continuous, solid, thick, 1-inch thick wood, and if there's no major damage in it, there's no rot or big warped sections or anything like that, there's absolutely no reason that you cannot go right on top of that. Of course, you're going to use an appropriate underlayment, like a heavy tar paper or something of that nature, but you could shingle right over that without having to add plywood sheathing. Plywood's not going to add anything to that but weight, so I think you're good to go.
Giovanni in New York, you've got the Money Pit. How can we help you today?
I have a septic tank that's a water softener flushes into. And we put a drywall years ago next to the septic tank for the salt water to regenerate and dump into. But when I, after, I don't know, 25 years or 10 years or 20 years, I can't remember, when they cleaned the septic tank out this year, they said the walls are becoming deteriorated to the tank because of the salt, and I might only have a 3-year life left in the tank.
What's the tank made out of?
Concrete.
I've never actually seen a septic tank wear out. I mean, I can buy that you may have some deterioration in the walls of the concrete, but, you know, unless they're broken up, I don't know if I would believe that you're going to have a 3-year life left in it. I mean, I think those things are pretty indestructible. Now, what did you have somebody open it up and inspect the inside of it?
Well, they cleaned the septic tank out about a month ago, before the holidays, because they had all the kids and the family coming over. And I was thinking, I didn't ask them the question, is it deteriorating from the inside, or is the dry well overflow from the water softener clogged up and pouring salt around the outside of the tank? I haven't been able to get back to him yet. He didn't return my calls.
Yeah. I don't have a high degree in confidence in the advice that you were given on this. I don't think I would be too concerned about it because I don't see salt deteriorating concrete. You know, it'll deteriorate the surface, but I don't think with all the water that's being run through there, I don't see it having that kind of a serious deteriorating effect. I mean, if you put rock salt on a concrete sidewalk, it's going to cause it to pit. You know, when you're using salt water along with the tens of thousands of gallons of other fresh water that gets dumped into that kind of a tank, I just don't see it as having the same kind of effect. Good luck with that project. Thanks so much for calling us at 888-MONEY-PIT.
Gary in Virginia reached out to Team Money Pit. Now, Gary says, I'm replacing floors and I'm looking for a recommendation here. I have 3 large dogs and a swimming pool, so the dogs are wet all day. I think he means the dogs have a swimming pool. I need something that will hold up to their nails running on the floor all day and will not be slippery due to the water from the dogs. Oh, my God. That has got to be a mess. 3 big dogs with their hair. I can imagine they're like dragging water.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, I'm thinking about the Stone Hybrid products as a really good option here, because what you need is a product that, A, is absolutely 100% waterproof. So that rules out pretty much everything except for maybe luxury vinyl plank, rigid vinyl plank, that sort of thing. And that's good, and it's pretty durable, but it's not as durable as the Stone Hybrid products. Now, I know that LL Flooring has one called Duravana that I've used. I tested this stuff when it first came out by trying to cut through it with a vibrating sander, and I took my framing hander and banged on it while I had it sit on top of my oak bench. I didn't dent it. I couldn't scratch it. And I've since used it in about 3 houses, and it's really holding up well. So I think that's probably a perfect option for here. And the best news is, not terribly expensive. I think it runs about $4 a square foot, but sometimes you find it for less on sale. So take a look at the Stone Hybrid products from LL Flooring or any other manufacturer that makes them. I think that's a perfect solution for a floor that's going to really stand up to dogs and cats and really any animals that you have around there with those long scratchy nails.
You know, just short of teaching your dogs how to use a towel, I mean, you know, if you can do that, I think we can.
Yeah, well,
we got a lot
that.
Of other things we can work on too. All right. Now, Tony wrote in saying, I got a new gas water heater with a vent that's an inch shorter than my old one. How do I make it longer? I think he sent a pic. Did you see it, Tom?
Yeah, he did. It's basically the draft hood on top of the water heater is not long enough. So that vent pipe is short by about an inch to an inch and a half. Now, you can't just like align it over the top there because it's not going to work properly. Now, let me just explain what a draft hood does. So the draft hood basically takes air from the house and mixes it with the combustion gas that's coming up through that gas water heater, and then it sends it out to the chimney. And it's got to be installed properly. And so in this case, what you need to do is basically extend that vent. If it was me, I would take the whole thing down and build a new one from scratch, because this way I know it's done perfectly. You can't stretch it. You can't just align it over the top of it. You got to replace it. And the other thing to know about the draft hoods is where it opens along the water heater. If you ever want to check your venting and make sure that nothing is blocking that chimney, if you put the back of your hand near that, you'll feel the steam coming out, kind of like what comes out of a tea kettle when it's boiling. You'll feel a little bit of steamy, a little bit of heat coming out of it. Don't touch it because it's hot. And that means that the chimney is blocked, and that's a problem. You can also hold the match near it and see if the flame leans in. But if there's any indication that it's blocked, it's got to be fixed immediately, because then there's a carbon monoxide danger.
All right. Well, I hope that helps everybody out. We are always standing by here at Team Money Pit to lend a hand, chat about projects you're working on, help you get inspired to tackle some new projects. Whatever it is, we are here to help.
This is the Money Pit Home Improvement Show. Thank you so much for spending a little bit of your day with us. If you've enjoyed the program, we would really appreciate it if you would drop us a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen to your pods. We'll be back next time with more great tips. I'm Tom Kreitler.
And I'm Leslie Segretti.
Remember, you can do it yourself,
but you don't have to do it alone.
Our bodies come in different shapes and sizes, so doesn't it make sense that our weight loss plans should too? That's the beauty of Noom. They build a personal plan that factors in dietary restrictions, medical issues, and other personal needs so your plan works for you. Noom doesn't restrict or shame when you want to treat yourself. Their flexible program focuses on progress instead of perfection. You don't have to give up carbs or anything. And with their daily lessons, you can learn something new about your food choices every day. After just a few days of using the app, I learned how to recognize cues for overeating and how to choose the right foods to feel full. Stay focused on what's important to you with Noom's psychology and biology-based approach. Sign up for your trial today at Noom.com. That's Noom.com. And check out Noom's first ever cookbook, The Noom Kitchen, for 100 healthy and delicious recipes to promote better living. Available to buy now wherever books are sold.